So for today's little Dhamma talk, I was reminded that I've talked about many subjects, and recently I was talking about, because it was the Chinese New Year, the year of the dog, I talked of Buddhism and dogs. So tonight I thought I'd talk about Buddhism and cats. And one good reason for that is because, you know, here in Australia, especially in the bush, the cats are an introduced species, just like most of us human beings here who come from overseas. And sometimes do we really fit in? And so in Australia especially, cats have got sort of quite a bad reputation. But nevertheless, you know, they are here. And sometimes the things which are not respected, sometimes you tend to find extra compassion for, you know, people who are rejected from society, who are on the edge of society, who feel afraid and not really have a place. But certainly that, you know, the cats have, you know, these little domestic cats, you see them, they're very, very lovable. But they're independent, but they're also very wise and smart. And so what place do they have, you know, in sort of a religion which is like Buddhism? First of all, they can be just a great symbol of something much deeper than just like a killer. Because sometimes those cats can be incredibly smart. And certainly one of the reasons I'm saying about cats is because even in ancient Egypt, in Egyptian culture, the cats were very mystical beings, and there's many statues of cats. And I'm not quite sure what the connection was with the cat and the Egyptian culture, but I was just told today, just by somebody, that they went to some ceremony, I think they said in Cornwall, and as they came out, he was with his sister. If I get this right, you can correct me afterwards. But these two cats came out, and one of the cats said to them, "Hello." A cat who could speak, which is a bit spooky. And then I was sort of telling all these other stories, which about things which aren't supposed to speak, which did speak. But he was saying afterwards, you know, his sister, you know, he thought he just was, you know, maybe he just imagined it, maybe it was like a special type of meow, who was, you know, which meant sort of something a little bit weird, and he didn't hear it correctly. But his sister said afterwards, yeah, that's what it said. It said hello. Two people heard it. Now, first of all, sometimes that it stretches our belief system. And I love it when it stretches our belief system. Instead of just saying, oh, it couldn't have happened, maybe it could. And that was where we had a conversation afterwards. This is not about cats, but about babies speaking. And which is weird, because it was that story, first of all, of here in Australia, this young couple, I don't know where they've got to, but they came to see us, I think it was here, and they weren't Buddhists, they weren't meditators, but they had such a spooky experience. They knew that in Buddhism we believed about, you know, reincarnation, many births, many lives, and we can go from many species to another species. And they were came very shocked. And they thought the Buddhists might be the ones who could actually explain the weird stuff to them. Because what had happened, they just had their second child, both two boys, and this was the Peter Paul story. And the second child, the youngest one, had just only been born, you know, a few days, and just came back from hospital. And having come back from hospital, was in, I don't know what, the baby carriage, the pram. They used to call it pram before, but it's whatever they put the baby in. Don't ask me, I'm a monk. Don't know much about babies. Except every now and again, we do a little ceremony in Buddhism as people actually offer the baby, and I've got to, you know, cut their hair. It was like a Thai tradition, the first haircut. in Bangladesh is given them their first spoon of solid food. And there's many, many things I feel very comfortable with, but I always get a bit scared when they give me just a pair of scissors to the first haircut of the baby in case it moves and you cut more than its hair off. But even worse, sometimes they actually in Thailand used to actually offer you the baby. You know, it's more like a baptism, like making it like the godfather, the Buddha father, the monk father. Thank you for laughing, that's made my day. And it puts me on there and on the robe, and I just try and do the blessing, whatever it is, as soon as possible, in case it poos on the, you know, and because, okay, yeah, and it's got the nappy on, but the smell goes through, and just, you know, you've got to go overseas tomorrow, and, but anyway, just these couple came, and they said the new baby, you know, was in the cot, and the elder son, Peter, they told him, go and say goodnight to your baby brother Paul. And so, you know, he did, he was about 2 or 3 years of age. He leant over the little cot and he just said, good night, Paul. And that was when Paul replied, good night, Peter. And that was weird because they heard it very clearly and they didn't know what to do. And they were just stunned, staring, just in disbelief. But without any prompting, Peter said again to his baby brother, good night, Paul. And this time they were both paying full attention, not imagining it, listened so clearly, and it said, good night, Peter, again. And they were so stunned because this was not imagination anymore, they heard it clearly, real story, not a joke. So they came to see, so the Buddhist monks, maybe you can explain it. And of course, we have other stories where people taught when they were just born. Why not? It happened. And just like in the end of life, we have this thing called lucid dreaming. That's not lucid dreaming, that's another phenomena. Of terminal lucidity. Just before a person passes away, sometimes they've been in coma for days. Sometimes it's just their brain has just been overtaken just by a tumor. Maybe because they've just got hardly any consciousness left, no brain left. But then they suddenly just wake up, open their eyes, and they become lucid. Without any reason, they can talk and they can remember everything, but they've got no brain left. These are weird things which happen, which in Buddhism, it's when the mind takes over. It's not the body anymore, because the body, is, you know, for a little baby, it's got no brain structures left. The neural connections haven't been made yet, but they're using something which was from their previous life. The same as the terminal lucidity at the end of a person's life. And this has happened for so many people. Even here, there was a doctor, I don't know if he's here this evening, male doctor, and he said that he was looking after a patient, and he got the warning, come to his bedside straight away because the dying process had already begun much sooner than expected. And the patient, older guy, in a coma, and so all he could do was just open the drawer next to the bedside cabinet, take out the address book, and ring as many of the relations as possible to get them to come to the hospital now. Your father is dying. And he was calling this guy's daughter. If I remember correctly, the guy's daughter was called Julie. And he was calling her on the phone, Julie, get to the hospital now. Your father's, you know, passing away, you know, now. And then he opened his eyes. And he said, tell Julie I love her. And then he closed his eyes and died, right there. He heard his daughter's name. He shouldn't have been able to talk at all at that stage. Came out of the coma, said, you know, tell Julie how much I love her, and then died. Terminal lucidity. The same as when a person just is born. Sometimes they have that lucidity. And of course, it was, once you mention that, those stories which should not really be able to happen, other people come and tell me their stories as well. Because I remember one of the first times I said that, there was a Malaysian couple. And they said, we never ever would actually tell anybody this, but seeing as how you brought it up, you know, that happened to our kid as well. That also talked as soon as it was born. We never told anybody because they thought that they think we're crazy, that we're mad, or we're on drugs or whatever. But it actually happened. But the best story, for those of you who ever go on retreats, I often tell this story during retreats, was when apparently it was in the United States somewhere, and this was actually in a hospital when the baby came out of the womb. And they reported this, the midwives, the nurses, whoever delivered the baby said this, it was true. As soon as the baby came out of the womb, still attached to the umbilical cord, and he looked around and said the unforgettable words, said in very clear words, "Oh no, not again." Been reborn, oh no, not again. So anyway, that's apparently true. So anyway, like a cat welcoming you. You know, it's weird, but sometimes you don't just dismiss things, that maybe there is something weird happening. And sometimes, a lot of times, we have this great superiority complex as a human race. I think we're so far, so far, far above the animal realm. But maybe sometimes we're not. And so that's why that sometimes, you know, the experience you have, just even with cats being reborn. There was, you know, I used to go quite often to, I still go very often to Malaysia, to Kuala Lumpur. And with this group that I've been looking after for a long time. And there was this great monk who used to be alive in the Brickfields Temple, Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda. He's been here many, many times, and before he passed away. And he's a very, very good monk, very, very open, and just very innovative as well. He's written many, many books here, which are well worth reading. Very down to earth and very, very wise. And he was told me, and I saw the picture, saw the cat, that one day in his temple, obviously this was one of the poor parts, it's the Indian area of Kuala Lumpur, Brickfields. And just in that area, of course, you know, there's many, many wild cats. And one day this cat just ran into the temple, just ran from nowhere. And they have their main shrine room, and he went right past everybody into the main shrine room, right in front of the big Buddha statue, and it stood on its two hind legs, two front legs, up together, two paws, looking up at the Buddha. And I saw that cat, and I saw they had a photograph of it. And I remember telling that Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda, he said, "Look, you know, you should, this is amazing, you should, you know, let people know this." And he said, "No, no, please don't tell anybody." Because he didn't want that cat, you know, to become some sort of celebrity, some sort of person who everybody would come to the temple just to see that. Because that's not the point of having a Buddhist monastery. You know, these sorts of things, we try and keep it quiet, but, you know, this was quite a long time ago now. But that was amazing. I've never seen a cat ever do that. You know, come right up, just by itself, not trained or anything, you know, just come up and just put its hand up and actually just to worship the Buddha. Weird. I remember seeing the pictures of it. But where did that cat come from? It was obviously just, you know, was reborn as, you know, from a human being to that. But anyway, that cat was very smart. For the rest of its life, it never had to worry about food. Never had to worry about a nice warm place to stay. That cat was protected. And so sometimes when we have the idea of reincarnation, there was a little video of a cat in a Korean temple or something, which would go to the chanting, would always sit there. But That was not as impressive as this Malaysian cat which I saw. That was really sort of weird and spooky, but there we go. But anyway, that they have, you know, sometimes it's not right to sort of demean a person because, you know, of their, almost that they have no choice, that just it's in their genes to sort of hunt birds and stuff in the forest. That's why that sometimes we don't like to have cats, you know, in forest monasteries where they will chase all the birds and actually do a lot of destruction to native wildlife. And that was the reason why that, you know, we had this one wild cat many, many years ago. And, you know, this again changed a lot of attitude to, you know, how I looked at cats. See, I knew about cats being very kind, and even this cat in Kuala Lumpur, which was an amazing cat. I'd never seen anything like that before, but we had a little cat who was a feral cat, or rather the young of a feral cat, little kitten. It was actually born in a log, you know, in a hollow log over in Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine. And I forget who it was who found it, but Amandus, you know, the Anagarika, knows that cat very well, knew that cat very well. And so that little cat just grew up with us. And it was a really smart cat, you know, and it would be playful. Sometimes that little cat, when the monks were going on a walk in the bush, the cat would always come along and just follow us. And sometimes it would hide behind a bush and jump out at me, playful. And I can never forget the time in one of those little huts. It used to sleep outside the hut, you know, just there was a little mat outside. And there's one of these really cold mornings, like, you know, we've had recently. You know, I was, you know, used to sleep on the floor in a sleeping bag. And so in the morning, you know, used to get up at 4 o'clock. And of course, the first thing you do, we don't have little toilets over there, inside toilets, you just go out in the forest, you know, to a little place where you can urinate. And as soon as I open the door, you know, to have a pee, the cat outside just ran straight inside my hut and went straight inside my sleeping bag to the very bottom, which was the warmest part. It was still warm. I'd only got out of that for, you know, for a minute ago. And he would not come out. Or she wouldn't. And stayed in there until it was the sun came up and it got warm. And so it had lots of these lovely little times with little Kit Kat, we called it. But then what happened with Kit Kat? What was really weird, and of course as many people know about this story, that it got to the time where the cat catching too much birds, you know, in a forest. We put a bell on it, but you know what happens with you put a bell on a cat? It just makes them become more mindful. And it's amazing, just they can move without that bell going off at all. And so it just made them more sneaky to catch. So after a while, what we did, and it was hard for me, I must admit, because, you know, you like that cat, it was just so friendly. And so it was almost like my cat. So we had to just find a home for it in the city somewhere. And that cat, you know, we know for 100% sure, was born in that forest monastery, and the only time he'd ever gone out of the monastery was actually to go to get, we call it like monasticized, so it wouldn't have any kittens. Okay, de-sexed, but anyway, we call it monasticized, in the vet in Byford. And even that, it felt really nasty about having to take it in there because it trusted me 100%, but I had to do it and came back again. It was fine. Well, I always remember it I went to collect it and it was just half in sedation, but as soon as it came up Kingsby Drive, it woke up and it could smell the area and it was just really sort of, you know, waking up from the sedatives, the anesthetic, because it was coming back to its home territory. And of course afterwards, It was there for a few years, but then when it got to the point that we had to get rid of the cat, so you know, you can't put it down or anything, you just find a nice home for it somewhere. And so we found a home. It was one of our ex-presidents here. And is Dennis still here? No, I think he has to go. But that was Chris Banks. And she was living in Waterman. You know where Waterman is from here. It's by the, it's about 10 or 12 kilometers. It's on the coast, you know, by the beach. And so we took it there. And again, it's one of those things I felt I was, you know, breaking the trust of this cat. This cat trusted me 100%. So when I sort of caught it and just cuddled it, and then I put it in a bag, because I didn't want it to see where it was going, and then put it in the back of Chris's car, in the place your feet go, so it couldn't see where she was going, because, you know, felt very bad that day, that, you know, just, you said this cat which trusted you 100%, we had to protect the birds, and she took it with, there was another cat there as well, and even though the cats are supposed to fight, those two cats, when it got time for the cold weather, they'd always cuddle up together, you know, just to keep warm, really cute. And anyway, that we took them up to a waterman, and she kept it in the bag until they went inside the house. When they went inside the house in Waterman's, she kept it inside the house for 3 days, you know, just to get used to the house and to try and forget, you know, the forest and the monks with which it used to live. And of course, first day, she let that cat out into the garden. And that cat, Kit Kat, bolted for the gate and just went right, I must have a space underneath the gate, the garden gate, and down the road. And this Chris tried to run after it, couldn't catch it, so I got into her car and started searching for it. Searched for it for a couple of hours, and then sort of gave up. It was a Saturday afternoon during the summertime, and I was on duty here in Nolamara Temple. And just where that office is now, where we have our meetings, we built that office only a few years ago. It used to be the main door to enter this place, a wooden door. And I just happened to be outside that door, on this side of the door, inside, when I heard, meow, meow, meow. And look, if you've, you know, lived with an animal, a dog or a cat, you know that's, hey, I know that sound, that meow. Every sound is different. And I opened the door and there was Kit Kat outside. And I know for a fact, because it's just a few moments later that Chris Banks, ex-president, she called. And she said, Ajahn Brahm, I'm just sorry to tell you this, you know, that I've lost your cat. I chased it, but it's gone. And of course I said, it hasn't lost it. It's here with me in Nolamara Center, in that room. And she couldn't believe it. So I think she got in her car and came here just to check out that it wasn't one of my jokes. It was actually real. But that poor cat, because I knew, I timed it, 2 hours, almost, you know, to the minute, from Waterman's to Nolamara. The freeway, you know, the Mitchell Freeway was there. So I don't know how it made it here, but its poor paws, you know, were just so hot because it had been running through the, you know, the hot, you know, hot, you know, no shoes on, obviously, and just, it was almost burning. And of course, you know, as soon as you recognized it was Kit Kat, if you gave it sort of a saucer of milk, and another saucer of milk, it was so dehydrated. And then it sort of, you know, took a rest. On, at that time, I wasn't the abbot, I was number two monk, and the abbot was Ajahn Jacquo. And he just went on top of his seat, had it over there, and peed all over it. He was stressed out, that poor cat. So, yeah, it stank for a couple of weeks, but oh, come on. you've got to let the cat, you know, just have a bit of understand what it's been through. So we try to wash it after the cat. But afterwards, it was amazing that it found its way in 2 hours, you know, for about, I think, roughly about 10 kilometers from Waterman to here. And it had never been in the Perth metropolitan area ever in its life. That was fact, could prove that. And how it could find me. And, well, yeah, you know, sometimes, you know, you don't wash your roads for a couple of days, but not even, no one could smell that from such a far distance. But it managed actually to get, you know, from Waterman's to Nonamara. Instead of actually going all the way to Serpentine, that's too far, much smarter than that. Take the shortcut and find somebody who it knew really well. And it found me in 2 hours, and that was just amazing. And after that, of course, you know, well, I realized these cats are really smart. They're, you know, I could you do that? You know, you can't, no GPS in those days. You can't call the RAC, you can't ask a policeman, please can you tell me the way to the Buddhist temple? Even most policemen wouldn't know which way we were, where we were. Weren't that famous or well known in those days. But still it found you so quickly. So of course after that, that cat just had, you know, we had to take it back to the monastery. It's a waste of time trying to get it out. It would just come back again, too smart for us, much smarter than me. So anyway, that it was weird that that happened. And of course we had a, not as amazing, but a similar experience happened a couple of years ago. And again, it was roughly about this time, when this lovely cat turned up, and it turned up Bodhinyana Monastery. And it was obviously sort of domesticated, because, you know, it was very friendly, a very furry cat, you know, lots of hair, and just, you know, really friendly. And of course, you know, it's very hard after a while for, you know, for the, to take it away from the monks, you know, because imagine, like, monks, you know, we don't have kids, you don't have a wife, have a nice little cat, and you can have a wonderful, like, emotional connection to a nice little cat, and you're not breaking any rules by stroking it or cuddling it. So it was so well known. So it came just at the beginning of our range retreat. And, you know, we asked around the local area, you know, has anyone lost a cat? No one had lost a cat anywhere around the local area. And so it was just in the end, after 3 months, we thought, okay, we might as well adopt this cat. It's so friendly and so easy to look after. And didn't chase any birds. It was a very good cat. And then afterwards, we had to take it to, again, the local vet, you know, because you have to get chips, I think, inserted into the cat, you know, for that's like the law, you know, to be registered. So we took it to the local vet. And then when we came back again, the local vet said it's already got a chip in it. Its name is George, and it comes from South Perth. So we found, we rang up the owner and said, well, I wonder where George was going. And we realized that what George had done, it just came to Bodhinyana Monastery for the rains retreat, for meditation. And many other people really try hard to actually to get on the list to come to a long retreat like that. And so that's what George did. So he came to, you know, a nice little holiday with the monks. But how he got from South Perth, you know, to us? We'd never seen it before. It wasn't one of our members or anything. You know, just, but he found his way all there. He said, I don't know how he got to, you know, it doesn't go very far. Somehow or other, it must have had like a Buddhist connection. And decided, okay, now let's make some merit by looking after the Buddhist monks, because that's a lot of merit, you know, allowing the Buddhist monks to create some loving kindness with some metta, because of course little animals, they do give the opportunity, like, for get some kindness and get some loving kindness and compassion coming up, and that's one of the reasons why people do have like dogs and cats, because, you know, sometimes you have a husband, you have a wife. And sometimes kids and, oh, just really. But it's amazing that sometimes these, you know, the cats and the dogs, they just adopt you and they're so kind to you. And, you know, you can relate to some compassion there and kindness. And that was one of the reasons why that I started, using that to actually to do compassion, kindness, forgiveness. Because that was the story where we had a new young Australian man who wanted to start his training to become a Buddhist monk. So when a person wants to become a Buddhist monk, same with the Dhammasaha to become a Buddhist nun, they don't just come in and ordain. They've got to sort of train first of all. They've got to make sure that they understand what a Buddhist monastery is and how it works. And we have to get to know them as well. And so this young man came in, explained to him, you know, the training. And first of all, when you become like Anagarika, you know, which is, you know, just, it means like, you know, you leave home. You just, you know, you first bit of renunciation. And this, we explained to him, as an Anagarika, you've got to keep what we call the eight precepts. And you've seen that over here last Waisak day, that many people kept the eight precepts, and one of the most important ones is you don't eat in the afternoon or the evening. You know, you just go without food, you fast. When I say fasting, it doesn't mean you go to McDonald's to take fast food. That's not what we mean by fasting. It means that, you know, you just have a good meal before lunch, before noon, and then afterwards you just say, have cups of tea, you can have honey, cheese, chocolate, that sort of stuff. But anyway, just that's only if you need it. So you just, you know, usually have enough for the one day. And that's not a hard thing to do, because having three or four meals a day, that is so modern. You go in history and people would only have maybe two meals a day, maybe 100 years ago, in the morning, have a light breakfast, and the main meal would always be in the evening when you came back home from work. You go earlier in history, and people would only have one meal a day, and that would be usually in the evening, you know, when you again come back from work in the farming economies. And if you go earlier back, then you'd only eat sort of one meal every few days, whenever you catch a woolly mammoth or something to eat. So, you know, it's quite okay just to do without food. But you know what happens? It's as long as you're in a supportive environment like a monastery, where everyone else is, you know, keeping eight precepts, you don't even think about it. Because you don't see food, you don't smell food, you don't prepare food, so it doesn't really matter. But now, what is really difficult is sometimes, you know, I go to these functions, you know, and they have these functions in the evenings. You know, they want to invite you, you know, to a state dinner or to a celebratory dinner or a fundraising dinner. And sometimes, you know, I get invited to those a lot. And I remember once it was a 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and Amnesty International here in Perth wanted to do a celebratory dinner, you know, to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. And they wanted me to come along and give a speech. They sent me this official invitation, Amnesty International. So I sent a letter back to them, return of post, and I said, thank you for your invitation. I'm very honored, but I have to refuse for the following reasons. Being a monk, I will not be able to eat any of that delicious food you put in front of me. You probably have wine, which I also will not be able to eat. And I'll be watching you all the time, enjoying your food and drinking your drinks. That is a form of torture which Amnesty International should never condone. I'm not coming. So I refuse. But anyway, so we don't have things to eat in the evening. But of course, when you first, you know, your body takes a while to adjust. And so this young man, sort of, he came to see me one morning and he was really, really upset. He hadn't slept that night. He said, Ajahn Brahma, I need to confess something. I feel so guilty because I broke my precepts last night. I was hungry. I went into the kitchen, which is not locked, didn't go in any old time. I went into the kitchen, I made myself a sandwich, and I ate it. I'm terribly sorry. I always remember it. And he had no real understanding of what Buddhism is. You know, he was just, you know, beginning to understand it. And I just told him, oh, well, you know, wonderful, thank you for telling me. It's important you actually, you don't keep all these things hidden, but you just confess them, bring it up, let me know. Then I said, look, number one, eat more at lunchtime. It was a simple thing, because when I first became a monk, I was getting really hungry. And I, you know, asked one of my fellow monks, I said, well, give me some tips, and there's some meditation I can do so I can, you know, not think about my tummy, and give me some other exercises or something. You know what he said? He said, eat more rice. I never thought of that. An obvious solution. So I ate more rice, that was a problem solved. So, you know, sometimes we look for really weird solutions rather than the obvious one. You know, if you're tired during meditation, what should you do? Give me a nice practice so I'm not so tired when I meditate. So, well, go to sleep. Get more rest, don't worry so much. But anyway, this particular fellow, I told him, look, these are the things you can eat. Eat more at lunchtime. You can, you know, take some, say, honey in the evening. That isn't allowable if you really need it. And so I told him all the things which, oh, thank you very much. And then I said, you can go now. But you know what he said next? He said, well, aren't you going to punish me? I said, what are you talking about? Well, you know, you've got to, I've done something wrong. I've broken an important rule. Aren't you going to sort of give me a penance or a punishment? To which I told him, we don't do punishments in Buddhism. It's one of the things which I was really impressed with. Now, the idea giving you a punishment to be a deterrent so you won't do it next time. And he said to me afterwards, he said, well, that's not good enough. Because the way I've been brought up, if you don't give me a penalty, a punishment, I'll do it again. You know, some people are like that. And so I was put on the spot. I had to find a punishment for him. And it just happened that morning. I was reading this book by Philip Hughes called The Fatal Shore about the early history of the settlers in Sydney Cove and about what happened to any of those convicts if they even did something slightly wrong. They had this brutal punishment of the cat of nine tails. And so it was fresh in my mind. So when he asked for a penalty, I said, well, this is Australia. I'll give you 50 strokes of the cat. Now it's amazing just how little people understood about Buddhism in those days. This fellow, he was wearing white clothes, but his face went whiter than the clothes he was wearing. You know what happens when people get really scared? Their lips start trembling. He really thought that I was going to flog him. And of course that's when I told him, I said, now listen, I sentence you to 50 strokes of the cat. We have two cats in this monastery. Find either one of them and stroke it. One, two, three, a whole 50 strokes of the cat. That's what 50 strokes of the cat means in Buddhism. In other words, learn some compassion, learn some forgiveness, learn some softness. And that was his punishment. Not a punishment just to create pain, but to gain some understanding, some wisdom and compassion. Don't be so hard on yourself, and so fault-finding, and so wanting to hurt yourself. And that was the punishment which became just part of Bodhinyana Monastery. If you haven't got a cat, sometimes the cats are hard to find. So that's why we have, if you ever go to Jhana Grove, our meditation center, you'll see teddy bears there. So if you can't do 50 strokes of the cat, 50 hugs of the teddy bear. One, two, or stroke. Now, people think that those are ridiculous solutions, but actually they work, because it gets you to something that the cat doesn't mind being stroked, and the cat will not sue you for abuse. You've got to be very careful these days. So you just pick up the cat and stroke it, and the cat loves it, and you love it, and you get lots out of that. And it also means it gives you a little bit of understanding about why we have this punishment and this guilt and feeling we're not good enough. The cats are always accepting. So, this is where we can learn that about a cat, about learning the cat can be a symbol of compassion for you. And again, the cats can be incredibly wise. Remember that story of this cat who was in the nursing home somewhere? I remember reading this. I can't really remember where it was. It became very famous. They put even a little video about it. And every time one of the patients in that nursing home was going to die, would always go into that patient's room and stay with that patient until they passed away. And the nurses were really freaked out because they'd see the cat go into a room. They didn't know this person was next to death, and the cat would actually sit on the bed, would not leave them in this nursing home until they passed, and usually in 2 or 3 days. It was a much better diagnosis of the illnesses than any doctor could ever do. And how the cat could do that, nobody could know. But people didn't mind that because it's just a lovely cat. So anyway, these cats, they do have amazing sort of powers, which is maybe one of the reasons why that they were even worshipped as like little demigods in Egyptian culture. And just why they can also be a symbol of kindness and compassion. They're not that far away from human beings. Sometimes they have greater wisdom, but I'd also use one of those stories of a cat, you know, Buddhism and cat, for some deeper Dhamma, deeper understanding. Because already, you know, I use this simile of a cat for meditation. Because sometimes it's very hard to describe, and this is just kindness. First of all, you know, just the great wisdom, the kindness, and now the peace and the stillness. And what happens when you get very calm and still? Now, even with little cats. Because when you do meditate, already I told you that when you really relax, your body gets still, it feels actually quite delightful. And when your mind becomes very peaceful and stops thinking, it does also create some energy and some happiness. And it's just so hard to actually to describe that, because it goes against the grain. People think that to get some happiness and joy, you have to have a strong cup of coffee, or your team has to win the World Cup, or you know, have to fall in love, or you know, get a raise from the boss, or whatever it is. We, you know, always associate happiness with getting something. And the happinesses which we discover in meditation, the spiritual life, is not in getting things, but letting go of things. Of things like, it was so wonderful to give, you know, in the last days of Kit Kat's life, it always come up to the dining room, and I'd always give it, you know, a little bit of milk and my own saucer. Never allow anybody else to do that. This is probably unhygienic, but always come up, just take a little bit of milk. And that gave me so much joy to do that. There's a little dog down the road here, always look forward to giving it a sausage or something. To actually to give something to somebody else is always a great sense of joy. You ever notice that? Not for what yourself. You know, you have, I'll just, because I'm traveling tomorrow, that when I was passing through Singapore airport, and I had some my eye shades, so I can actually go in an aircraft and just put the shades on, and it can meditate, so you don't see people. That's, you know, one of the things which I got them in my bag for tomorrow, an eye shade. And earplugs, so I can meditate inside a plane. Nothing else to do. Except for sometimes people recognize me these days, so I'd never forget this time, coming back from Kuala Lumpur. I just sitting quietly by myself, ready to meditate, and then this lady comes up, "Oh, Ajahn Brahm." And it really worries me when people recognize me. "Oh, Ajahn Brahm." And he said, "Oh, I've always been wanting to ask some questions." And I told her, this was from KL Airport, I was coming back to Perth, and I said, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, there's a gentleman already sitting next to me, so, you know, maybe another time." You know what she said? She looked at the gentleman sitting next to me. I was in a window seat, and this gentleman was in the aisle seat. He said, "Oh, would you mind swapping seats?" And I didn't know what to do, you know, it's just, you know, you can't sort of say no. So I was just trying to use my powers, and I was just close my eyes. Say no, don't say no. but my powers must have been really weak because he said yes. And for the whole journey from Kuala Lumpur to Perth, about 5 hours, she was talking all about her problems. I couldn't escape. I was in a window seat, but I don't remember that flight. Anyway, so anyway, I had just passing in Singapore on the way somewhere from some place to another place, and there's this lady there. You know, she was trying to get some rest. She was on the bench, you know, on some seats, and tossing and turning, and just obviously the, you know, it's very bright and noisy. And I just stopped by her and said, "Hey, do you want some eye shades?" And she looked at me so surprised, and she put them straight on, fell asleep, and I felt so happy about that. That made my whole trip. You know, it's better than anything else. Just you gave something, gave people some happiness and peace. So that little bit of giving is a wonderful thing to be able to do. So it's all about sort of giving, letting go, not accumulating things. So I used a story of a cat as a symbol, as an understanding of what happens in meditation. And that was the story of the Cheshire Cat from Alice in Wonderland. And Alice with the Looking Glass, Alice with the Wonderland, one of those two. But the story was that Alice, it was so well written by this Charles Dodgson, who was a mathematician, his pen name was Lewis Carroll, that Alice saw a cat on a tree smiling at her, a Cheshire Cat, which is supposed to have a smile on its face. And the cat kept on disappearing and then suddenly appearing again. And Alice said, "It makes me so giddy to see you appearing and disappearing so quickly." And so the Cheshire Cat replied, "Okay, I will disappear slowly for you." And so there was the cat. I think in this story it was just the cat's head. But I think in my book I did the whole cat. So the whole cat, first of all, the tail disappeared. And then the legs disappeared. And then the body disappeared, leaving only the head. And then the ears vanished as the Cheshire Cat vanished slowly. And then the whiskers disappeared. And then the eyes disappeared. And then the nose disappeared, leaving only the lips which were smiling. And then even the lips disappeared, leaving only the smile. At which point Alice said, "Such curious things. I've often seen a cat without a smile, but I've never before seen a smile without a cat." And I use that simile because this is a smile. Without a body to feel that smile, without a mind on which that smile is pasted onto. A smile, a happiness, without anything experiencing that happiness. A disembodied joy and peace. All because things vanish slowly. First of all, you're sitting here, and then your body vanishes, disappears. You're in your mind, you can't feel your legs, you can't feel your hand or your head, it disappears. Because it relaxes, it starts to vanish. That's why it becomes happy. Stuff has disappeared. Just like the end of the working week. Free. And then time vanishes. No past, no future. You let go in this moment. Nothing to worry about. All the stuff your fellow workers said to you. All the worry about having to start a new job in a couple of weeks' time. All of that is vanished. So you're just here, free. When things vanish, you become really happy. But then it gets really deep. Because you stop talking to yourself, the inner speech vanishes. You're watching your breath, and then the breath vanishes. It gets curiouser and curiouser, as Alice used to say. And the more things vanish, soon even your mind disappears, leaving only a smile. Very curious. You've often seen a person, a mind which is not happy, a person without a smile. But how many times have you seen a smile without a person? That is deep meditation for the Cheshire Cat. And that sums up Buddhism and cats. Meow, meow. I said, sorry, meow, meow, meow. We always do things in threes in Buddhism. So now instead of sadhu, 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 meow, meow, meow. Okay, one, two, three. Meow, meow, meow. Okay. Any comments from the floor? Buddhism and cats, to make it fair on the dogs. Okay, from Brazil. Oh, they got some cats, great. My cat was always with me while nursing my sick dog. This is from Brazil, first of all. So these talks that go all over the world, you know, people, because, you know, sometimes people, I don't feel like coming today, it's cold, or I've been working hard, but some people, they're overseas, different countries, and they feel you guys are so lucky, you can actually come in and see us live. Actually, you've got some people from Canada here, they just checked in with me earlier, just so they see me on the YouTube, and they just happen to be passing through. But anyway, from Brazil, so great, in Brazil you could check in. My cat was always with me while nursing my sick dog who passed away recently. Since that time, my cat is agitated and unsettled. What can I do to help my cat let go and get a good rebirth, especially since it has killed birds? It's killed birds, but it's a nice cat. Just a nice time is like forgive the cat for its faults. Just look at the many good things in your cat. Of course it's agitated because, you know, even it's dogs and cats, you know, sometimes they're supposed to fight, but sometimes they love each other to bits. You've seen that, looking after one another, cuddling up together. And because of that, if one disappears, the other one, you know, tends to go through grief, like everybody else. Animals go through grief as well. This is weird. This is about parrots. There was a parrot which was on the corner of Kingsby Drive and the Southwest Highway. That's where our monastery is. Because one of the workers there saw it one morning, standing on a branch of a tree, looking down, and there was a dead parrot just on the road. You know, parrots, they mate for life. And after he finished work, he saw that parrot on the tree had not moved. Next day, it hadn't moved. It was there for 3 days. He saw it, a parrot sitting on the tree, looking down at its dead, had been hit by a car, just looking down for 3 days until it sort of finished its mourning and then went away. Animals feel grief as well. So that cat was agitated and settled. Please just give it some extra TLC, allow it to let go. And no joke, just let it listen to these talks. Honestly, no joke. I told you last week that people showed me the video of their dog listening to my talks. I forget what country they were. I think it was Germany, I think. They had it on their computer and the dog was there looking. One of my great followers. Anyway, so to get a good rebirth, just let it sort of listen to some talks. You know, you become a good person, a kind person, and then the cat will pick it up from you. And from Germany, cats and dogs are magic beings, and by touching them, they give us instant peace, strength, love. Do they know or see the time and place between death and rebirth? I mean, ghost cats, ghost dogs. I've already made the one story about the ghost dog, and that was in the story about dogs. Actually, there's a couple of stories about ghost dogs. There's the other story about, you know, the dog lady over in Rolleystone. Should I have said that? Well, it's on Kalamanda. And anyway, that she was alone, had a dog, only companion, and used to go for walks up in the forest with the dog, morning and evening. And one day, she came home from a walk and she'd lost her fingering. It's a fingering story. And she went back, you know, with the dog, trying to find it in the forest, you know, looking hours, but no way could find it. You know, a little ring. She knew roughly where she lost it. She had it on her finger when she left, and she knew, just, you know, playing around with the dog, where it must have been somewhere, but could not find it. And then soon forgot about the ring because the dog died a few days later. And because the dog died, she forgot about it. But you know, she comes here and she said she swore to me she heard that dog in her house, the barking of the dog. It was her dog. She lived with it for such a long time, she knew it was her dog. I could never see it. You know, hear it in a room, open the door, nothing there. And then one day, she was by the front door of her house, the entrance door, and a dog, she could hear it barking really loudly the other side of the door, just, you know, a couple of inches away. So she quickly opened the door, no dog. But right in the middle of the welcome mat, her fingering. She'd been in and out of that house so often, and that was just there after the dog had found it for her, barked, fingering was there, never heard the dog again. The dog had one last thing to do, find a fingering for her, and then disappeared. So really nice. So yeah, they can know and see, and just like after people before they go. And anyway, from Canada, after my cat passed away, I kept seeing him from the corner of my eye when getting up at night. During meditation, he came to me physically and I petted him. Did I imagine all of this? Probably not. Not imagination. You came to see you just one or two last times and then petted him and then off they go. That was the other story, just not far from here. The dog, this, oh, you can actually don't mind telling him that's Pon, you know, runs a Thai boxing gym, demonstrations here. And anyway, his next door neighbor, a builder, and he had a dog, and the dog died, had a cancer. So the next day after, you know, went to the vet, was injected, died in his arms, in the owner's arms. And so the next day he got up to go to work, the builder, and outside the door of the house was his dog. He'd already been put, it was dead. And the dog went right past him and sat in his favorite corners of the house, went out to the leaky tap and just had a drink, you know, from the leaky tap where it always used to go. Then it was like a double-story little townhouse, upstairs to his wife's bedroom. And just, the dog would always go to work with the master, you know, just, that was, hang out with the builder. And so, went up and would always go and kiss the wife. You know, lean up, and the wife was just, you know, half asleep, hadn't really woken up yet. And so just automatically, you know, forgot the dog had died and just, and kissed the ghost dog. So be really careful what, you know, you kiss early in the morning before you really wake up. And then the dog came down. And then the fellow just, he actually had his camera, got a few photographs of the dog. And so, you know, he sent the photographs to me, it's real. And then the dog went to jump in the back of the ute to go to work. And the Buddha said, no, enough. And so the dog looked at him and turned around, ran the other way down the street. The Sabasa saw him. Ghost dog. One last time to come and visit home. So, from Canada, your cat passed away. I kept seeing him from the corner of my eye while getting up at night. During meditation, he came to me physically, and I pet him to imagine all of this. Probably not. But then after a while, just say, time to go now, cat. Wish you a nice life. You know, I love weird stuff. Because it just pushes the boundaries. It just makes life, you know, way more interesting. So if you do lose a cat and a dog, which these days is just like human beings, and there's a good reason for that, just they may come back, but then just say, okay, now take a good rebirth. And if your child always likes lounging around and going to sleep, curling up, who knows what they were before.
Meow, meow. Woof, woof.
Okay. So any questions from the floor here? Okay. So now let's pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Oh, by the way, there is a nice book which I read this when I was a lay Buddhist, called The Cat That Went to Heaven. It's in our library now. We've got two copies. It was the book of that day, that monastery, that temple in London, which was taken out of the library the most frequently. It's a very beautiful book, The Cat That Went to Heaven, in our bookshop here. Not only to loan, not to take.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namasami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami